Good morning, happy Valentine's Day. Welcome to The Other Animals for February 14th, 2020. I'm your host, Laurent Levy, and before we get started, I just wanted to pass along my condolences to the family of WWDB's own Tim Halloran, who passed away this week. He was a friend of the show. He was an invaluable colleague to get it off the ground, and our thoughts are with him and his family. All right, so being Valentine's Day, I thought this might be the perfect time to dive into that most controversial of animal topics. Can animals love? I mean, there's no question that we can love them, but what are they really feeling when they look back at us and lick our faces or nuzzle their cheeks in ours or even return hugs for those lucky enough to have been hugged by a bonobo? For people who are around animals, there's no question that this is love. But for those old sticks in the mud out there, and I'm talking about scientists, ethologists, biologists, and the like, those unempirical, unpeer-reviewed, undouble-blind sentiments just aren't good enough. They need proof. And in the absence of that proof, well, if it's unproven, it doesn't exist. Historically, this denial of emotions, even of sentience, has opened the door to an anything-goes attitude towards animals. Descartes famously compared what we would see as emotional responses to the mere mechanical reactions of a machine. Do animals really have emotions? Do they love? And does science really have any business helping us figure that out? Our guest today, Mark Beckoff, has devoted most of his adult life to answering these questions, and he'll help us figure out love and the emotional lives of animals today on The Other Animals. But first, it's time for Animals in the News. Okay, being Valentine's Day, you're going to love this one. This comes to us from San Antonio. Yes, if you want sweet revenge instead of chocolates for Valentine's Day, the San Antonio Zoo in Texas has said it will name a rat after your ex and feed it to a snake today on Valentine's Day. The zoo is charging $25 for this service, but there's a cheaper alternative that's just as spiteful. For only $5, you can name a cockroach after your ex, and the zoo will feed it to a bird or another animal. And even if you or your exes don't live in Texas, you can still participate in this feeding frenzy because the zoo is live streaming the event on Facebook. Do I need to comment on this? I will tell you this. It strikes me as probably one of the most grossest thing I think a zoo has ever done. I know we have talked about having the zoo episode here where we're going to have the debate, and it's coming one of these days. All right, one other story to get to here. This comes from our friend Jane Desmond, who was on a couple weeks ago, and she will be on back with us for part two of her talk. We may not know about this, but it has to do with the global donkey crisis. May not know this, but in China, donkey skins are valued for their gelatin. This is a key ingredient. I'm going to mispronounce this, in something called ijiao. It's a traditional Chinese medicine believed to treat illnesses as diverse as anemia, insomnia, and reproductive issues. But China's own stocks of donkeys have collapsed 76% since 1992, and its annual supply of about 1.8 million donkeys cannot produce enough skins for a surging market, which now demands at least 4 million lives a year. In fact, if its current pace continues, more than half the world's donkeys would need to be slaughtered in the next 5 years to feed China's growing demand for ijiao. Contributing to the problem, global donkey trade is only loosely regulated. A report in November 2019 by the Donkey Sanctuary linked the trade to criminal networks, animal welfare abuses, increased international biosecurity threats like the spread of anthrax, ecological pollution from unregulated dumping of millions of donkey carcasses, and devastating effects on rural families who have their donkeys stolen. It's actually rather long article. I encourage you to read it. I'll have it up on the website. To summarize, the lives of the donkeys are miserable that are in this trade. It's almost like a slave thing. They're torturous. They're crowded into trucks and driven for days without food or water. They arrive at the slaughterhouse with broken bones and open sores. And, this may seem like, well, it's China. What do we care in America? But the U.S. is the third largest importer. Do you know this? the third largest importer of this ijiao from mainland China, only after Hong Kong and Japan. So it's not that remote. More on this. This is sort of a concerning story. All right, finally, we've had in the past several shows the topic of the so-called vegetarian dilemma. That is the conflict that confronts people who eat plant-based diets when it comes time to feed their meat-eating pets. And it just so happens that our friend and frequent contributor, Hal Herzog of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat fame, just happens to have published an article in Psychology Today on this very topic. What are the odds? And here again, once again, to mess with our heads, Hal Herzog. Welcome, Hal. How you doing?
Well, thank you for having me. Mess with their heads, come on.
You're the head messer in residence here. That's your official title. So I like this one thing you had in the article that sort of opened it, and you refer to it as the moral calculus of pet ownership as owning a cat versus owning a snake. Set us up with that. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, this is an odd thing, but I was once accused of picking up kittens at my local animal shelter and then feeding them to my son's boa constrictor. He had a baby boa constrictor. And I was horrified. I don't know how that rumor got started, but one of my animal rights friends called me up and said, "How is it true? Are you really getting kittens and feeding them to boa constrictors?" And I said, "Of course not." And I never found out how the rumor got started. However, I did start thinking about the ethics of keeping a snake for a pet. And the snake snake whose name was Sam, ate about one small mouse a week. And so I figured, basically, I did the math and figured that he consumed probably about 6 pounds of meat a year at most. And then I figured out, well, seeing that cats are kittens and cats are obligate carnivores, how much meat is consumed by a typical pet cat? And I concluded that it was, gosh, well over 50 pounds. And so what I concluded was that the moral cost of keeping a boa constrictor for a pet was vastly smaller than keeping a cat for a pet.
Okay.
And furthermore, I calculated that the cats owned by animal activists and animal protectionists consumed vastly more animals than were used in research. Used in research every year in the United States.
Oh no!
So I've been thinking about this for a long time.
Well, then, as I said, then you add in this thing that keeps coming up with us is the cats that are catching the birds out there, right? So they're much more. All right. So what happens with the owners who are plant-based and they're
yeah, this becomes a problem. And I realized this when I was doing this early study I did of animal rights activists, and I interviewed a woman named Lisa who was a vegan, and I was interviewing her house, and I noticed that she had two cats, which she deeply loved. And I said, "Well, you're a vegan, you don't eat any meat. What about your cats? You have these cats that are carnivores. What do you feed them?" And she said, "Oh, no, I wish you hadn't asked me that. That's my biggest moral problem. I love these cats. They love meat. They need it. What am I going to do?" And she was really torn about this.
All right. So what? So what's the what? Do they have an option? Do they? Is there a vegan option for cats that's healthy? Let's start with that.
Well, the PETA says yes. And if you go to the PETA website, you can find a list of vegan foods for cat and dogs. But most researchers say no, that cats are obligate carnivores, and particularly they need an amino acid called taurine that occurs naturally in humans and dogs, but not in cats. And the reason why I wrote that Psych Today piece was that a researcher at Guelph University did a study of what vegetarians and vegans and omnivores fed their cats and dogs. And surveyed 4,000 cat and dogs owners, and about 12% of them were vegans or vegetarians. Nearly all the vegetarians fed their pets some meat. However, 10% of the vegans raised their cats on a vegan diet, and 30% raised their dogs on a vegan diet. It's sort of an interesting thing. And if you ask them, what would you like your pets to eat? 70% of the vegans said they'd really like their cats and dogs to go vegan, compared to 20% of the omnivores. Mm-hmm. So this is a big issue. I think if they could genetically engineer or somehow come up with a with a plant-based with a plant-based cat food, particularly, that there would be a substantial market.
There would be, and yeah, I mean, that's what I'm thinking. If it could be done healthy and costly, you know, cost effective.
Yeah.
I mean, I have five cats, and I'm right in there.
You're a killer then.
Thanks for that. Right.
Five.
Yeah. Here's the mental gymnastics I play when I'm in the pet store. Is I like to believe that what I'm buying is a byproduct. In other words, they didn't go out and slaughter the animals for the pet industry. The cats and dogs are getting the leftovers, if you will, the part that uh-huh. And I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just saying that's how I try to deal with it. But you know, the thing is, who coined the term the vegetarian dilemma? There is sort of an inevitability to it, and it really just points to our what I think is so intriguing is that you know, it's the theme of the show is that we have to be inconsistent and we have to grapple with that. All right. So speaking of that, now you had another article that sort of fits into the same thing about.
Yeah, it definitely fits into this. So your form of denial is to so the way you get around this is to say, well, they're byproducts, which is possibly true, but probably not, because some of those byproducts, for example, chicken feed, there's an enormous demand for those things in China. So I feel the same way. I delude myself into thinking that the chicken that I buy that says cruelty free is actually cruelty free when I know deep in my heart it's not.
Okay.
However, there is another way some people get around this. And there was recently a study. It turns out that 40% of vegetarians eat fish. So they're able to call themselves vegetarians at the same time, and vegetarians by definition are not meat eaters, but at the same time they eat fish. Mm-hmm. And a young psychologist named David Rosenfeld at UCLA, who's done some really great work in these types of areas, surveyed vegetarians, people that consider themselves vegetarians, and also pescatarians, people who ate fish. So 37% of the pescatarians that he talked to claimed they were vegetarians.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting part is that half of them, one of the questions that he asked were, all his subjects were, are fish a form of meat? And 40% of this particular group said no. So they don't consider fish meat.
So there's your mental gymnastics.
What are they? If they're not meat, you know, are they vegetables? Are fish plants? So there's there's lots of ways we can delude ourselves.
There's a foundation for the people coming in from the previous show. I happen to know this in terms of kashrut, the Jewish dietary laws. Fish are not meat.
Yeah.
Fish are not meat, and there's laws that relate to putting eating dairy and meat together. You can have milk, dairy products with fish. That's okay. That's considered kosher.
I did not know that.
I'm wondering if that's bleeding into that. I wonder. All right, Hal. Thank you very much as always for your insight, and we need to keep doing this because we need to get shaken up from time to time, and no one does it better than Hal Herzog. Thanks, thanks for your time.
Thank you. I love the show. I love what you're doing.
Terrific. All right. When we come back, it'll be my conversation with author, scientist, and cognitive ethologist Mark Beckoff. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
And they called it puppy love. That's right. right. Puppy love on Valentine's Day. You get it? The incomparable Donny Osmond. All right. Going off script for a moment, our listeners might know my own background with classical music. And I believe if you had to compare today's guest with the great composers, he could only be Mozart himself, combining a prolific repertoire with astonishing quality. Just like Mozart, his works and accomplishments are simply too numerous to mention, so I'm unfortunately compelled to condense. Mark Bekoff is a professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder, a fellow of the Animal Behavioral Society, and a past Guggenheim Fellow. In 2000, he was awarded the Exemplar Award from the Animal Behavior Society for major long-term contributions to the field of animal behavior. He's also an ambassador for Jane Goodall's International Roots and Shoots program, in which he works with students of all ages, senior citizens, and even prisoners. And he serves as co-chair of the Ethics Committee of the Jane Goodall Institute. He and Jane also co-founded the organization Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. He's the author, co-author, or editor of at least 30 books, 21 of which have been translated into languages, and more essays and articles than can be surmised. Mark's works are truly global in their reach and impact. And now we're going to have my conversation pre-recorded with Mark. Stand by 1 second. We're having just a couple little technical items here. I'll tell you this. One thing Mark and I were talking about as we're getting set up here, Mark was absolutely outraged at what I was talking about with the San Antonio Zoo, and some of that comments were I did not include them in the edited version here, but he had a particular opinion on that. Okay, now we're ready for Mark's.
It's a great honor to have you on, Mark Bekoff. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have to say, I mentioned all your publications, and we could go through a lot of your work. And I have to say, I for this program, I have proudly on my desk the Encyclopedia of Human-Animal Relations, and that has helped me more times than I can count just to use reference material. So that in itself is is something. I thought being Valentine's Day that we might focus on and the emotional lives of animals, and the topic of emotions in animals in general. All right, well, let's start, go to the magnus opus here, the emotional lives of animals. And that goes back, that was published in 2007. And, you know, to some degree, many of the arguments, they seem obvious to us now. You know, of course, animals have an emotional content to their lives, right? Yeah. But it seems like it's taken us a long time for not just us, but for the scientific community to accept this. Why is that? And have we accepted it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, the emotional lives of animals was actually finished around 13 years ago. But if I were to rewrite it, and we didn't rewrite the book, but Jessica Pierce and I published a book in 2017 called The Animal's Agenda, which really updates everything in the emotional lives of animals. So in some ways, people look at that as kind of a second edition. I mean, the public, if you will, non-researchers, non-scientists, haven't doubted the fact that a wide variety of non-human animals, you know, aka animals, have rich and deep emotional lives. I mean, there's just wonderful essays and books written, you know, even more than 100 years ago on that topic. Mm-hmm. The resistance really came within the scientific community with some kind of a legacy, or I like to say, like a, you know, some whiplash from René Descartes, who, you know, famously thought that animals were machines.
Clocks.
And that
everything was a clock, right?
Everything was a clock. And when you heard a moan in pain, it was like the gears grinding in a clock. And then, of course, the school of behaviorism came with B.F. Skinner and the Skinner box, and looking at everything as pretty much stimulus response relationships, arguing, forget about the brain, you know, which he and the behaviorists called the black box. But, you know, there's also a social sort of responsibility side to it, or an ethical side. And that is, if you deny that non-human animals have rich and deep emotional lives, then you can do anything you want to them.
Yeah.
The real question that I always have is how many scientists really believed that, you know, in their heart while they were torturing dogs, cats, and other animals. And something
had,
that...
Yeah, I was going to say, for them to do that, though, I mean, how do they turn that off? All right, if they're going to, like you say, they are torturing, they're doing these really nasty experiments, they have to somehow believe that they don't have emotions. Otherwise, there's a disconnect in the scientists. No, I mean, what's really going on in their mind that they're saying, no, they don't have an emotion so that I can do this?
Well, yeah, I mean, one of my arguments is that there's been so many studies on animal pain, and if you didn't think animals suffered and had pain, why would you study and try to produce animal models of pain? But, you know, I just think that a lot of them just really believe that humans trump. So, you know, most of the research that's been done that's really invasive isn't to learn about the animals themselves. It's to learn, it's to gather information that can help humans. So I always say it's research in the name of humans. But scientists are really good at overcoming cognitive dissonance. I mean, and I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way, but once they get going on a certain thing, a certain topic, it's pretty easy to, you know, keep going on believing that you're doing good. You know, people just wanted to learn about, if you will, humans, and so they use animals. Another example that's egregious is the studies in learned helplessness, where animals are basically trained to avoid a shock and on a grid, and then they're not allowed to avoid it. And rats were done, and dogs were done. They were done at the University of Pennsylvania years ago, all in the name of trying to understand depression and other, if you will, human psychological conditions. But of course, animals get depressed. Just look at animals in a lab or in a zoo. And another was a set of experiments done by somebody named Kurt Richter, who basically would have rats swimming, would save some, and then he wouldn't, and he watched them drown. And I'm telling you, you know, people don't believe this, but it's a fact. And so I think what happened is people just decided, well, non-human animals are disposable, and we can do anything we want to them. But once again, as you pointed out, it's astounding that they could overcome the dissonance. And on the one hand, say, we're going to study mother love, for example, Harry Harlow with his famous wire mother studies, which were just horrific, abusive. Yes. So a study mother love, that's what he called it. Mm-hmm. And he and his students tortured macaques in their lab. And then, of course, somebody came along and tried to figure out how they could rehabilitate them. Not to rehabilitate them because of what they did to them, but rather to rehabilitate them to learn how we could apply, you know, say, psychological rehabilitation to humans.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Yep. I was going to say, it's really interesting, the concept of when they run these experiments, the idea is, even though there's been this disconnect of the animal, you know, the non-human animal as not having the emotion, we're trying to compare. They're trying to ascribe a comparison somehow. And as if only by making the comparison is that we could then, comparing to humans, could we possibly then validate that the animals have an emotion? And I wanted to get into that because you speak in the book about this phenomenon. I think we call it argument by analogy, right?
Yeah.
And we really concentrate, as an example, on, for example, comparing physiology. So when humans discovered in humans this functioning of the amygdala, the part of the brain, I'll let you talk about that. And only when it is discovered, animals also have an amygdala. In that case, but if they hadn't had it, if that comparison hadn't been valid, well, then all bets are off. I just wonder if you could talk about that whole concept of argument by analogy.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. But then when they learned all this information, years ago, it's not like just yesterday, they never used it on behalf of the animals. And one of the changes now, too, is there's remarkable work using neuroimaging and magnetic resonance imaging on non-human animals, and a lot of really good work being done on dogs. And so the reason I mentioned dogs is because that's kind of been my specialty for a long time. And, you know, we're discovering now that the same areas of dog brains light up when we, if you will, imagine they're experiencing certain emotions that humans experience. And so a lot of people buy the fact that non-humans have emotions when you do, if you will, the reductionist work, the mechanism work, the neuroanatomy, the neurophysiology, and other experiments like that. But still, there are some people who go, we really don't know. And one of the arguments, I call it the as if disclaimer, people go, well, dogs are only behaving as if they're in pain, or as if they're depressed, or as if they love, or as if, you know, they're stressed, et cetera, et cetera. And that as if disclaimer is just absurd. And one of the things that I do, because I do study dogs, is when people start talking about other forms of abuse or the emotional lives of other animals, and they're mammals especially, although we know a lot more now about birds and fishes, for example, I'll say, well, would you do to a dog what you do or allow to be done, say to rats, mice, and other animals, including birds? And they'll go, oh no, I would never do that. Well, why? Because we don't want to harm them. And I'll go, okay, wait a minute. Fair enough. Yeah. What about the other animals? And a lot of them, I mean, really a lot of them have that aha moment, because I'm a nice guy, I'm not saying it in their face, but the question, would you do it to a dog, or what do you think about your dog, you know, really brings it home, or a cat, if you will, too, or another companion animal. Mm-hmm. But the good news is that although the Animal Welfare Act in the United States is utterly archaic, I've got to say that more and more people, including researchers, are becoming a little more responsible in their research. It's not necessarily driven because of an ethical concern. It's really driven because they know that the quality of the data they collect is really better. I mean, because studies were studying, you know, joy in rats, were studying grief in guinea pigs, but you're studying it in stressed animals.
They're engaged.
And fishes too. And so, So the point being that you may be collecting data that are reliable, but they're only reliable if you throw the word stressed in, which is why so many studies on animals do not transfer over to humans, or when the data are used to and applied to humans, it doesn't work because you're studying the behavior or the physiology of stressed fill in the blank animals. Mm-hmm. And so frankly, if that changes the paradigm, I'm happy, but I wish there was a little more ethical concern for the individuals who are being studied.
I mean, that seems to be the rub there, right? Is that you're trying to apply a quantitative scientific rigor to this thing that is by its nature not quantitative. You know, how do you put numbers around emotion? How happy are you? It seems to be I'm using the word like an oxymoronic kind of a dilemma, because you should be able to accept. We think we can look at, like you talk about your dog. Your dog is wagging its tail. It's doing the ears are up. There's no doubt about the mood and the emotion of the dog, just by the fact that you know your dog, you're around the dog, you understand the behavior. There's no question. And yet it seems that there is this need to quantify it, to put a binary thing around it. And is this what in your specialty, this is what I think we call this cognitive ethology. Is that, am I right in that special branch that of this that you focus on, cognitive ethology, is trying to bridge that between those two, between the scientific and the emotional, if you will?
Yeah, it is. So cognitive ethology, for those who don't know, is basically the study of animal minds. I like to define it as the study of animal minds, non-human animal minds, and what's in them and how do they work. And so, I mean, I'm a scientist, and I'm happy to see rigorous, non-invasive science being done on non-human animal emotions. And that's why I really like the work that's being done, a lot of it at Emory University, because I really like the fact that the dogs in these studies do it voluntarily. They're shaped, if you will, to get used to an MRI machine. And, you know, the work that's being done is really, really good. And like I said, you know, the animals get used to the machine. You can do the brain image.
Can I ask you about that? Because I read so much about that. And there was one even last week. They put an octopus in the MRI or squid.
Yeah, yeah. So, right. So
isn't that a stressful? I mean, how the heck do you get the animal, if you would, how do you get the animals in the machine? I hate being in the MRI. How does the dog get
well,
in there?
I can't answer with the octopus, but I do know the dog work. Greg Burns at Emory and his team have been doing it for quite a number of years, and he uses his own companion animals or pets. They really shape them. They get used to being in to lie still. They do it, you know, with rewards and stuff like that.
Okay.
And, you know, the pictures I've seen and talking to Greg and, you know, seeing some of his talks, they really are. And I understand your concern because, you know, in an MRI machine, you don't want any noise and if the animals are stressed and moving around. But the data are solid. So here's a good example. For years, people wondered whether dogs felt jealousy.
Okay.
And, you know, you could talk to people at a dog park, and if you talk to 100 people, 100 will tell you they do. But what they did was they set up in a situation where a dog would be jealous, say, seeing another dog have food. And, you know, comparable to, say, a situation in humans when you would think that I might be jealous of you in a certain situation. It turned out that when they did the neuroimaging on the dog's brains, the same areas of this dog's brain lit up as in humans. So that is as good as you're going to get for the fact that, yes, dogs experience jealousy, confirming what almost everyone else in the world knows. But it's nice to have the confirmation.
Yeah,
you know, some people go, gee whiz, we knew that. But the reason I'm mentioning that is simply because the closer you get to, if you will, the neural basis, and you show that the neural basis for certain emotions is the same in humans as it is in other animals, people become more convinced of it. But frankly, I think
it's the science become more convinced of it. The dog owners didn't need convincing in the first place.
Exactly. But as more and more scientists are aware of that, and as more and more scientists are concerned about the quality of their data and the public pressure, I mean, I encourage people to put the pressure on for full disclosure of the way in which some studies are done, because, you know, people talk about Harlow studies once again, or these learned helplessness studies, or these drowning rat studies, and they don't think about what they really mean. It's not because the people are dumb or don't care, but when you tell them how these studies are done, they actually are offended. They really are. And there was a move to convert, you know, the learned helplessness studies in a certain way to try to now focus on, you know, different aspects of human behavior, because the depression model didn't work, it failed. But, you know, I really think with letters I'm getting, and nobody writes letters anymore, but with emails I'm getting and stuff, more and more people, especially young researchers, grad students, advanced undergraduates, postdocs, talk to me about doing more ethical research. And that's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, their definition of what's ethical and mine may not match, but the fact that they are
that they care about it
yeah. is a step in the right direction. So we are moving in the right direction. I mean, I really feel we are. It's going far more slowly than I would like, but we are moving in the right direction. And the one thing I always say is that, you know, I would stop certain practices yesterday, but sure. society doesn't work that way. So yeah. I'm look for the little
incremental.
All right. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Mark Beckoff, and we'll get into the real nitty gritty of love. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
This is the night when the heavens are right.
All right, so for, I almost feel like I should do a trivia quiz on this, but remember the theme, it's Valentine's Day. So for any of you Disney aficionados, that is the song that was playing. That's the theme song as Lady and the Tramp romantically eat their spaghetti. All right, let's continue our conversation now with Mark Beckoff, speaking of love.
Yeah, being Valentine's Day, give us some examples of your observations of real-world animal love.
Well, I mean, it depends. You know, one, of course, would be mother love for her young, if you will, you know, out here in the West, but anywhere, you know, they say don't get between a mother bear and her young. I'm a field biologist. I do field work. And, you know, just watching wild coyotes. We did a long-term study of wild coyotes in the Grand Teton National Park. Of course, there's this long-term study of wolves in Yellowstone. But, you know, just look at the reaction either between a mother and perhaps, you know, the father and their children. And the reason I say that is because scientists like to call the young of non-human animal young, they call them the young or their offspring, but they are their children. And people don't like to use that term, but it's absurd because they are their children. When you start calling them children, then you begin to get that feeling that there is this intense positive emotion, enduring emotion. They take care of them. It's reciprocal. The young seek out their parents. The parents go off and look for the young or protect them or take care of them. So that's, you know, that's clearly love with a capital L. And so, you know, once again, when people think, you know, that, oh, you're being anthropomorphic. I think that's number one, I should say that. I think it's useless to have those discussions any longer because we know that non-human animals experience a wide array of emotions. So we're not inserting anything human into the animals. That's who they are. But, you know, you can see courtship love. I mean, I've watched, you know, wild coyotes form mated pairs. They spend a lot of time courting one another.
How do coyotes court? What do they do?
Well, if you've seen courtship in dogs, it's pretty much the same as courtship in wolves and coyotes, for example. They greet one another. They form a bond. They start spending a lot of time with one another. They sniff one another. They travel with one another. They will sleep with one another. And they become, you know, if you will, protective of one another. They'll defend their prospective mate against interlopers. And it's kind of the same kind of pair bond, you know, that is formed in humans. And then, you know, they'll have babies. And, you know, in a lot of species, the males take off you know, in addition to human males who sometimes take off. But, you know, this courtship bond really is one that I couldn't call it anything else but love. I mean,
whales, and you talk about whales. It's a similar. They do. They sort of do a similar type of ritual with the dancing and the not dancing, but the fins and the slow ritual.
Oh yeah, you'll see very elaborate courtship in different birds and fishes, and there's just. I mean, people will go, well, we don't really know it's love, and I. You know, sort of when, depending on the mood I'm in, if I really want to be sarcastic, I'll go, well, humans aren't exactly the good model for love.
Right, there it is. You know, it's funny. It's like the reverse of, you know, it's like we're trying to project our version of love on them. And who are we as a model? You know, we're, why make that comparison, right? Whatever we want to call it.
What's also interesting, we were talking about the history of the study of animal emotions, is years ago, most people didn't hesitate to allow people to use some of the words that describe negative emotions, like fear and stress, and, you know, even, you know, dislike or hate. But if animals, you know, can be upset, they can love. You know, there's two sides to that coin, and it's something I point out all the time. But once again, you know, when you're attributing positive emotions to an animal, it just makes it hard for you to be, you know, to justify and rationalize the mistreatment of them as individuals. You know, I always say to people too, and people go, oh, well, they're dogs. Well, dogs are real animals. Dogs are mammals. Yes, they've been created by humans, but, you know, they come from wolves and they're real animals. And if we can learn so much by studying their emotional lives and apply it to canids and apply it to us. Yes. Yeah. Our relationship with dogs says a lot about us.
I mean, there's so much to learn. I mean, there's all, I was thinking of, I think you have it in the book too, the, it became popularized with the movie, but the penguins in Antarctica, and those are examples of, they mate for life, right?
Yeah, the penguin example is an interesting one because I actually studied the Adélie penguins in Antarctica, and you know, more and more research is showing that they're not as monogamous or as attached to one another, but that's not to say that some aren't, and that's not to say that they can't form strong bonds. But, you know, monogamy is quite, you know, prevalent in the world of birds. You know, they estimate that maybe 97% of bird species are monogamous. So, you know, I mean, are humans monogamous? Some are and some aren't. But I wouldn't say that we should use ourselves. And I don't mean it in a sort of, you know, facetious way, but we shouldn't necessarily, you know, use ourselves as the models. But when animals form tight bonds, they really are tight bonds, and they'll go to very extreme ends to maintain those bonds, and in the sense of, you know, courtship and mating, and really protect their mate or their spouse. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
one of my big things is when people say dogs are unconditional lovers. They're not unconditional lovers. They're very selective, and it really upsets me. Because if you've ever rescued a dog or been around a dog who's been abused, they're not unconditional lovers. And the other side of it is that, you know, dogs are our best friends.
Yeah, yeah, we're almost out of time. I want to ask one last question though. That I don't know, and maybe if it's too personal, you can tell me now. But the concept of that individual, you mentioned in the book this really personal story of this. I think it's an epiphany moment for you with Speedo the cat.
Yeah.
And was that, what's curious about it is that cat, you know, I'll let you describe these series of experiments, but Speedo had a name. And I just wonder if that was what that moment did for you. And if you would just tell the listeners what I'm talking about here.
Sure. I mean, yeah, so I was in a PhD MD program, and part of the PhD work was looking at the neural basis of brightness discriminations by cats. And part of the research, which was basically related to, if you will, neurosurgery in humans, was if you remove, say you have to remove a chunk of the brain, should you do it all at once or should you do it in sequence, say two separate operations? And so part of that research project, and I'll say that I was very far away from it, thank goodness, but it was a project that I could have gotten really deeply involved in, was to operate on cats and remove part of the visual system, either in one big procedure or two sequential procedures to see which one was better. So, you know, there was some application. And then the cats were tested in a discrimination of how, you know, how well they could discriminate brightness. So as the study went on, and I, like I said, I really didn't partake in much of it, but it was in the lab I was in, I was beginning to think about it. And one day they called me in and they said, well, we want to test cat number 38 or whoever the cat number was, because they don't name animals in a lab.
Yeah.
There's more and more people doing it, but it's frowned on because once you name an animal, you
that's
have a connection to it.
That's just what you're talking about. Yeah.
To him, you have a connection to him or her. So this cat was really smart. It was running, you know, the mazes and learning. So I secretly named the cat Speedo. And one day I went in with the team and Speedo didn't know me. I'd never met him before. And we locked eyes and he told me with his eyes, like, this is not good. Why are you doing this? And to be honest with you, I walked out and I left the program. I mean, that was it. And so it was an epiphany, but it wasn't something that I wasn't, it wasn't something that was unexpected, because my folks told me that when I grew up in Brooklyn, which is where I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, when I was 2 and 3 years old, I was always asking them what the dogs, cats, squirrels, and birds and ants were thinking and feeling. And so what it was an aha moment, because I'd never been exposed to that kind of research. I mean, and so that was my aha moment. It wasn't an aha moment, if you will, in terms of learning that animals have emotions. For me personally, it was a moment when I decided I don't want to spend the rest of my life torturing animals. And so I left and I went on to, you know, a different sort of career.
That's beautiful. That's a really positive outcome for that. So that's a great way to wrap this up. All right, Mark, people want to get more information about any of your publications or your books or anything, where can we send them?
I think the best place to go is my homepage is markbeckoff.com. And as much as I dislike sometimes sending people to Amazon, they do a good job of cataloging books. So all my books are listed there and my homepage, you know, just has some good general information.
Excellent. All right.
And I also write regularly for Psychology Today in the Animal Emotions site.
Yes. All right. I definitely want to thank you for your time. And we'll have to have you back sometime. So definitely.
All right, and that was Mark Beckoff, and I found that a really fascinating conversation. And there's actually more to that story, that Speedo story. I encourage you to actually get that book. It's a landmark book, The Emotional Lives of Animals. And as he's saying, there's several follow-ups to it now, but it really broke the mold when that book came out. And it's one to have on your shelf if you're an animal lover. All right, when we come back, we'll be talking here with Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. Stay home.
And we're back on The Other Animals, WWB, and joined now by Dr. Tom Picard himself of All Pets House Calls. Tom, welcome.
Yes. Well, before I comment on the previous thing, I just wanted to share something I had read this morning, as it is Valentine's Day. And granted, I read it on the internet, so take it for what it's worth. But I'd read that Valentine's Day was actually based on a pagan celebration. And what that was that women who felt that they were with a worthless man took that day to murder them and pass around their heart to other women in celebration, and would then put flowers on the graves of previous men that they had murdered for the same reason. So anyone who comes up to you today to hug you, check their hands first would be my advice.
And you happen to say this in a day when my wife happens to be here in the studio, so I hope she's not paying any attention.
Or cares about you and thinks you're worthful.
Yeah, right.
So, but anyway, yeah, as far as the other aspect, there's a million videos online. You can find them. It's like clearly animals show compassion. They have unsolicited reactions to human beings and other animals who are clearly under some sort of stress. Yeah. Even whether it's crying or even less visibly, clearly they're used for comfort animals, for, you know, soldiers coming back from war and people who go through other things. And anxiety and things like that. You can't have compassion without love. It's they're hand in hand. It's nearly the same thing. So it's, to me, that's proof.
I think so. And I thought it was interesting what he was saying, you know, or what the our conversation, that the there is this, why does love, you know, we can't even define love. You know, we can't even define it. And so this challenge that animals can't love, or that if we say, oh, they're demonstrating love, well, we're just projecting. And to me, that's bunk. You know, I mean, if we perceive, you know, the dog looking at us in the eye, or the cat, you know, coming to us, or whatever, that, or, you know, the examples you have, then why not call it whatever you want? But we perceive it. We are the recipients of it. The animal, the dog or the cat is responding in kind. It's love, right?
And, as far as I could tell.
Yeah. All right. What'd you think of our other favorites? It pops up from time to time, but Hal Herzog, when he was talking about the vegetarian dilemma there for the dogs and cats, the diet and looking for non-meat options there.
I think it's very valuable to have these moral discussions with yourself internally, and to think about what it means to you, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. I think, you know, I have no evidence that animals have anxiety about moral dilemmas. Now, maybe they do, who knows? But I think we do transfer a lot of our own anxieties and moral dilemmas onto them. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be blessed without that anxiety, I think.
That's a good point.
And they have too much time where they spend anxiously debating what is right and what is wrong. I think just they do what comes to them naturally. There's certain things that they were designed to eat. There's certain things that they eat they don't get enough nutrients from if they only eat that. And, you know, human beings can have their own moral and ethical and reasons for eating what they want, and I completely respect that. I just think we have to consider closely the physical biology and et cetera that animals have before we try and impose our own morality and anxiety on them.
Yeah. I mean, people who refuse to, they don't even want to consider any plant-based diet, this is from the person's perspective. And they'll cite as an example, well, look out in the wild. The animal, you know, the lion is hunting the gazelle and has no moral quandaries about it. And it's the most natural thing in the world to kill for your food and eat it. So why should we be any different? And I look at that as, well, but you're picking and choosing. You're saying, well, we have these a negative behavior as well. you're just being an animal. You're just being an animal. And you want to, well, you're going to emulate that. You're not going to emulate a higher behavior. And I look at the lion eating the, you know, out on the Sahara there, that it's necessary. It's usually, there's no waste. It isn't even comparable to what happens on a factory farm, you know, where millions of animals are just processed in a mechanical way. So this, you can say that, well, the lion doesn't really have a moral dilemma. And I say, well, good for him, you know, because that lack of a dilemma is in everyone's best interest. Even you could argue even the gazelle that's being eaten, because it's not hundreds. He's not being tortured in the process. I mean, doesn't want to die, but there's something to be said about that clarity. I'm thinking.
I agree, and I think a lot of the problem people do have, and they should have, is the unethical and immoral treatment of animals, especially because in this world today, it's a mass production scenario. And it's changed the way things are for the worst. I understand people completely who have a real moral and ethical problem with that.
Yeah.
And I do as well. I mean, animals shouldn't be treated a certain way, at the same time, there's also, it's obvious that there's animals that just shouldn't be eaten whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly, just look at the cases of these viruses that are cropping up more and more. Yeah. There's direct correlations to the animals that these are coming from. I have never had a desire to eat a bat. There's a reason probably for that. And we're finding out that they're a carrier. They're a mammal. They're a carrier of dangerous viruses. You should not be eating these things.
Yep.
Other things, consider on your own. But look at the list of things you shouldn't.
There's common sense gets in there. I hate to fall back on it, but there somehow that we talk about the moral dilemma. Well, that works its way in there too. All right. That's about all we have time for today. So I definitely want to thank my guests, Hal Herzog and Mark Beckoff. Special thanks to Dan French joining us now on the board, an engineer. As always, we'd love to hear from you with comments, ideas, or suggestions. And of course, if you'd love to sponsor me, I would love to hear from you. Check us out on theotheranimals.com. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iroarpod.com. Next week, we're going to buck tradition. I'm putting buck tradition in air quotes. We're going to head out to the rodeo. With film producer and Action for Animals chair, Eric Mills. A very interesting guest. You don't want to miss it. And until then, find a belly to rub. We'll see you then.